You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Jim Duffy. It may come as a surprise to many listeners that the law pertaining to surrogacy in the UK is governed by primary legislation enacted 40 years ago, the Surrogacy Arrangements Act 1985. The Act makes it a criminal offence to enter into commercial surrogacy arrangements in this country. Indeed, it's also a criminal offence to assist someone with such an arrangement for profit. So while surrogacy is a practice that's become more and more prevalent in recent decades, the legal framework has long been viewed as requiring some fairly major surgery to bring it up to date with modern society and practice. Here to talk us through where we're up to and what might need to happen next are two specialists in family law from One Crown Office Row, Claire Chaborowska and Pauline Troy. Pauline spent 12 years as the senior partner in a large criminal and family law firm before coming to the bar in 2011 and joined our Brighton team last summer. She has over 36 years of experience in children's law. Claire Chaborowska is a specialist in family proceedings concerning children. She acts in public and private law children matters and has particular expertise in private law applications involving questions of parental rights, parental responsibility, child arrangement orders, and applications for specific issue and prohibited steps orders. Claire has experience of representing same-sex parents in cases involving assisted reproduction, and she also regularly represents the interests of children in private law disputes. Claire, Pauline, thank you for joining me. Pauline, before we look at the state of the law around surrogacy in 2025, it's important to understand something of the history, and it's inextricably interwoven, isn't it, with progress in the field of LGBTQ plus rights going back to the 1950s.
That's right. And what I'm very keen to ensure is that people who are coming out today understand that history and the battles that have been fought in the past, particularly in the context of family law. So, for example, back in the 1970s, 1980s, the case law was very homophobic, particularly to lesbian mothers, and often in the context of divorce, because women were under a lot of social pressure, gay women were under a lot of social pressure to get married. And when those marriages inevitably broke down, it was very difficult for the women to retain what was then called custody of their children. And it wasn't uncommon for the courts to consider that children being brought up by lesbians would be blemished or permanently scarred, deviant, unnatural. All of that kind of language was used in the context of women who were trying to ensure that they brought up their children as best they could. So it was a very hostile environment. It's probably worth looking at that era from the perspective of what was happening in gay society generally. So everybody's probably heard of Alan Turing. He pleaded guilty to gross indecency in 1952. That was 5 years before the Wolfenden report was undertaken, which was really about reforming the criminal law in relation to that. But it took another 10 years before the criminal law was reformed in 1967, such that two gay men in private would not be committing an offence, but any sexual activity in public or involving more than two men was still a crime. And the age of consent was 21. And astonishingly, that law change in 1967 didn't actually take effect in either Scotland or Northern Ireland until 1980 and 1982, respectively. And of course, again, the public will know, in the late 70s and throughout the 80s, the AIDS pandemic was also something that fueled homophobia. So it was a very, very hostile environment in which to be an out, proud individual.
And Claire, that brings us to the mid-1980s and to the UK's first surrogate. So that development was taking place against this backdrop that Pauline's described that had been going on for the previous 30 years.
Yes, indeed. And I was born in 1982. And so I obviously have no memory of the 80s, but having grown up as a child of the 80s, it's quite astonishing to me to think that those were the attitudes at the time that I was born.
Yeah.
And we get to 1985 as the first publicised surrogacy case, and that was the case involving Kim Cotton. And Kim Cotton had agreed to carry a child from an anonymous couple in the United States and became the UK's first surrogate parent. The baby was born in the UK, but became a ward of court as soon as the baby was born, whilst the juvenile court, as it was known at that time, decided whether Kim Cotton or the intended parents should take care of the child. And there was quite a lot of uproar at the time. Some of the front page headlines were basically very scathing, saying Scotland Yard's investigating a surrogate mother in London following reports she's to receive £6,500 for her baby from a childless couple, I think was one of the headlines. And if you were to account for inflation, I think the £6,500 back in the early 80s is about £25,000 in today's money. And so there was all the discussion then about being paid to be a surrogate parent and obviously what the ethics of that were. And so that was the first real publicised case of somebody accepting payment to be a surrogate in the UK. And that then led to the 1985 Surrogacy Arrangements Act, which then criminalised commercial surrogacy and made it clear that surrogacy arrangements are not enforceable in law. So a surrogate cannot be forced to hand over the baby if she changes her mind. And it also made it a criminal offence to initiate, take part in, or agree to negotiate a surrogacy arrangement on a commercial basis or compile information for the use in doing so. And so surrogates and intended parents were at the time excluded from that offence, so they could legally negotiate their own surrogacy arrangement. But at that stage, lawyers, solicitors couldn't give professional advice on a surrogacy arrangement in exchange for any payment.
Because of that prohibition upon the arranging or facilitating of arrangements.
Yes, and then around the 80s as well, 1988, we had the Section 28 of the Local Government Act, which was again very controversial legislation, which effectively banned schools from any teaching about gay relationships and regarded it as the promotion of pretended family relationships, which, of course, hearing that phrase now is obviously extremely offensive. But it did prohibit schools from promoting the idea that homosexuality was a valid or acceptable form of a family structure. And so we still saw that in the late 1980s.
So it still feels like we're firmly in the dark ages at that point, Pauline, but we're approaching the 1990s and new wave of societal developments, beginning with the regulation of fertility clinics.
Well, that's right. But I mean, the situation with Section 28 is something that I remember very, very clearly because I was in my early 20s at the time. It was a bill going through Parliament, obviously, for a period of time. I think it started off from memory as something like Section 21 or Section 22. Went on so many marches and had a T-shirt with whatever relevant clause it was at the time. I wish I'd kept them. And as I say, it was a very, very hostile environment. But yes, we do enter the 1990s against that backdrop. And it was still quite a hostile environment. The first HFEA Act was passed in 1990. Really, the purpose of that was to regulate fertility clinics. And of course, the first so-called test tube baby, Louise Brown, was born in 1978. So we had, by this point, 12 years of IVF with science and research growing in the way that it was. So I suppose society was crying out for some regulation. And it did also create the parental order, which is the application that intended parents have to apply for if they want to confer parenthood on themselves in a surrogacy situation. But it was still a time of discrimination. In 1994, there was a parliamentary debate about trying to equalise the age of consent. That was compromised with it being reduced down to 18 rather than 16 for gay men. Of course, 1998 was a massive development with the Human Rights Act, and that was absolutely crucial to some of the cases of discrimination actually being fought and won successfully. There was a very famous case in 1998, which became known as the Bolton Seven, which was when a group of gay men at a private party, it was effectively an orgy, they were all consenting adults, but because there were more than two of them, they were prosecuted and convicted, and they did eventually in 2000, through the European Court of Human Rights, have their convictions overturned because the prosecution was considered to be a breach of their Article 8 rights. At the same time, people were being sacked from the military for being gay, and it wasn't until 2000, again on the back of Human Rights Act cases, that the employment discrimination against gay people in the military came to an end. And I remember actually only literally a couple of weeks ago, I saw a post from an ex-military person who said words to the effect of, "I got a medal for killing two men and discharged for loving one." And it rather sums up how poignant that would have been. And of course, in the employment field, it was massive in terms of pensions and so forth, and recognition of next of kin and things like that. So that's the 90s.
So by the turn of the century then, Claire, there have been significant developments in this area, or touching on the area of surrogacy law. And those then seem to finally have accelerated somewhat from around the mid-noughties, is that right?
Yeah, so I think the first major piece of legislation in the early noughties is the 2002 Adoption and Children Act, but that didn't in fact become effective until 2005. But that represented a significant legal transformation, because when it passed, it allowed unmarried and same-sex couples to adopt jointly. And prior to this, only married couples or individuals, regardless of sexual orientation, could legally adopt children. We then see a further development in 2003, that the offence of gross indecency that Pauline referred to earlier in respect of Alan Turing was then removed. Things developed again further, and the Sexual Offences Act of 2003 decriminalised consensual sex between men. Prior to this, the offence of gross indecency was often used to prosecute acts of a sexual nature, particularly between men, even if consensual and in private. And in fact, thousands of men had been cautioned and many prosecuted for those such offences. And then a further development led to, in 2004, the Civil Partnership Act. December 2005, it's possible to then have the civil partnership, allowing same-sex couples to form legally recognised civil partnerships with the same rights and responsibilities as those enjoyed by opposite-sex couples who marry. And then, of course, it's later extended to opposite-sex couples via the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act of 2013. And then we see a further development in the case law, with quite a significant case of Re G in 2006, which is a House of Lords authority, with Baroness Hale giving the leading judgment. And that decision recognised the role of a psychological parent. And that term is really the first time that that's developed in the case law. In that case, there were lesbian parents who decided to have children together via anonymous donor insemination at a clinic abroad. But sadly, the relationship broke down. What that case showed, however, is that the relationship which develops through the child demanding and the parent providing for the child's needs, initially at the most basic level, feeding, nurturing, comforting and loving, and later the more sophisticated level of guiding, socialising, educating and protecting, that encompassed that phrase psychological parent. And it came from, I think, as Baroness Hale sets out in the judgment, the work of Goldstein, Freud and Solnit, Beyond the Best Interests of the Child in 1973, who defined it as, a psychological parent is one who on a continuous day-to-day basis through interaction, companionship, interplay and mutuality, fulfills the child's psychological needs for a parent as well as the child's physical needs. The psychological parent may be biological, adopted, foster or common law parent. And so that really was the first time that even if you weren't a child's legal or biological parent, you would nevertheless be considered the child's psychological parent, which would have applied in many same-sex relationships.
And that takes us up then to the new Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act in 2008, Pauline.
Yes, so this was a really, really important development, one that actually, from my own personal experience, would have welcomed. My own children were born in 2005 and 2006, and I had to go through a step-parent adoption procedure, which is obviously very intrusive and strange apart from anything else. So this new provision that would allow two legal mothers to be named on the birth certificate just cut out all of that process of step-parent adoption. It has obviously led to issues which we'll come on to in terms of you can only have two legal parents, not three. But it really did make a huge difference to so many families. I think in terms of the human fertilisation system generally, the most important development under the Act is that it amended the law to include the welfare checklist from the Adoption and Children Act in considerations for parental orders, which surprisingly wasn't a major consideration under the earlier scheme. And it does mean that it's the welfare of the child throughout their life. And as a result of that, there's actually been a case. Mrs. Justice Tice actually made a parental order in respect of somebody who was an adult. So it does affect you throughout your life. But it did also provide a bit more leeway under the Surrogacy Arrangements Act, because it meant that organisations could offer advice and support on a not-for-profit basis. So people weren't totally going underground to do this. It also clarified the legal status of sperm donors, because basically the legislation says that where the child has got two legal mothers, no man will be treated as the legal father. And it also meant, of course, that donors clearly don't have any financial or legal obligations towards the child. And I think everybody welcomed the legislation change at the time, because it did mean that things were much more straightforward, although as we'll see later on, there's still significant deficits in the system.
Thanks, Pauline. So that's the historical backdrop up to around 2009, which is when Alan Turing was given a public apology by Prime Minister Gordon Brown. And then we have the new Equality Act enacted in 2010. And by that time, where are we up to in terms of the concept of legal parenthood and the rules surrounding it?
I think it's important to remember that legal parenthood is different from parental responsibility. So legal parenthood governs factors such as financial rights and responsibilities over a child, including their inheritance rights and immigration, and also who can be registered on a birth certificate. So for couples who conceive a child naturally, the biological parents will always be the child's legal parents. But then post the HFEA 2008, for children conceived using assisted reproduction, the rules are governed by that act. And as Pauline's already set out, it means that you can have two female parents registered as the child's legal parents. And so in law, it's considered that the birth mother will always be the legal mother of a child, even if it's not her eggs that have been used in the process. If the birth mother is married or in a civil partnership and their spouse or civil partner has consented to sperm donation treatment, then that spouse or civil partner will be the child's second legal parent. But if not married or in a civil partnership, then the intended father for heterosexual couples or second female parent for same-sex female couples will have to satisfy the agreed fatherhood or agreed female parenthood conditions before the artificial insemination takes place. And that's governed by Section 37 and Section 44 of the FHEA 2008, and only for treatment that's taken place at a UK licensed clinic. Otherwise, the sperm donor may acquire legal parenthood and associated rights. And so again, parental responsibility is not the same as legal parenthood. And in law, a child can have only two legal parents. Even though the sperm donor is the child's biological and genetic father, he will have no legal rights in respect of that child. But again, as we see later, setting out the boundaries and the expectations of what that relationship looks like, so between the genetic donor father or genetic father and the child, can cause problems further down the line if there is a dispute.
Pauline, going back then to what's happening outside of Parliament at this time during the 2010s periods, what's going on in terms of societal developments around these issues at that time?
Well, I think the Equality Act coming into force in 2010 has made obviously a big difference to how people are able to function in their lives, particularly in employment sectors and the like. And of course, there are a number of protected characteristics which include sexual orientation, gender recognition, biological sex, and so forth. We've also been mapping what happened to poor old Alan Turing, because he started off obviously being somebody who felt compelled, unfortunately, to take his own life after his conviction. But as we've already indicated, by 2009, he was being given a public apology by Gordon Brown. And then in 2013, he was actually given a royal pardon. And that was a really seminal moment, because it then opened the door to all the men who'd been convicted or cautioned for gross indecency were also formally pardoned in 2017. And that meant that effectively the law was recognising that the legislation that discriminated against those men should never have been passed in the first place. And that was a very emotional time for a lot of gay men who had lived with the stigma of the way that society treated them in the first place, but also having a criminal conviction.
Yeah.
So that was really, really important. And we've then got in 2019, PIFA legislation was amended to allow a single person to make an application for a parental order. And that was on the back of Mr. Justice Mumby deciding in 2015 that it was a breach of human rights not to allow that. And then, of course, Alan Turing, bless him, has ended up on the £50 note in 2021. So he's now a national hero. And I suppose that does indicate how far we've come between the 1950s and the 2020s.
Indeed. And that's what's happening over that period in the last decade in Parliament, in society, up to and including the Royal Mint. But Claire, what's happening then in the courts? How are they regulating the various rights and responsibilities that arise in terms of the biological father, private donors, and so on?
So I think obviously the intention behind the HFEA 2008 was to really provide legal certainty, but it's not until we start seeing some of the cases through court that we realise actually there are some problems arising.
Yeah.
So for example, in 2015, the case of Re-X, which again was dealt with by Mrs. Justice Tice, that involved same-sex civil partners and a private donor. And the question was, what role should the private donor play in the child's life when the donor is not, in fact, a legal parent? Mm. So obviously, the donor being the genetic biological father, in that case, was seeking fortnightly contact with the child to include weekends, overnight stays, time in the holidays. So a relationship is being established. But the civil partners recognised the donor's role in the child's identity, but didn't, in fact, support there being any direct contact. So the civil partners in that case said that the biological father undermined their role as parents by seeking effectively an enhanced role in the child's life that wasn't ever the intention. And I think it's a difficult case for Mrs. Justice Tice to grapple with, but she does give a very clear judgment. And in her judgment, she said it's quite clear that these parties wholly underestimated the emotional consequences of the arrangement they embarked upon. And for differing reasons, they've each struggled to come to terms with the position they are now in. But what the judge felt was that the child in that case was too young to express any views about having contact with their genetic father. In fact, in that case, there was no existing relationship between the child and the genetic father. All of her physical and emotional needs were being met by the excellent care being provided by her parents, her legal parents, and she is wholly dependent on them. And that any direct contact between the child and the genetic father would bring little positive benefit to the child, and it would put at risk the security of her placement, both in the short and long term. The infrequent direct contact would not maintain any existing relationship between the child and the genetic father, and would very likely lead to the expectation by the genetic father that it should increase. Any direct contact would be against the express wishes of the civil partners, and that may further undermine the child's secure placement with them. I don't know whether Pauline has any view about the use of the word placement in that judgment, but it's rather suggestive of it being akin to an adoptive placement rather than it being an established relationship where the child is born into a loving relationship. That's just an observation.
Definitely.
Certainly coming from outside of this practice area, I was quite surprised to see reference to the word placement, and it seemed to me to describe something different to what the law is. Pauline.
I think the language and vocabulary in this field is really tricky. And those of us who practice in the field of public law children's work probably would use the word placement without even thinking about it, just within your vernacular, as it were, or your vocabulary. But actually, when you are a parent involved in this situation and people are basically assessing you to care for your own children or asking you questions about how many O-levels you've got, as if that's going to assist a judge in deciding whether or not it's in your child's best interest that you are allowed to adopt your own child, it becomes very frustrating and very intrusive, I have to say. But I just think everybody needs to be really careful about the language that they use. And in cases where neither the man nor the mothers are seeking any involvement from the male, the appropriate word to use is donor. But in circumstances where the individual man is either seeking or offering a relationship and the mothers are open to that relationship, the situation becomes much more complicated. And in some circumstances, the appropriate word is father, but in others it might not be. And everybody, I think, needs to have an open discussion about the vocabulary that they feel comfortable with, and the courts and professionals ought to take the lead from the family members involved, whatever that may be, would be my view.
And certainly in that 2015 case, Mrs. Justice Tyas felt that it was not in the child's welfare interest for there to be any direct contact with the child's genetic father, because to do so would place the child at an unacceptable level of risk of emotional harm by putting the security of her placement with the civil partners at risk. And so she felt that indirect contact once a year would meet the child's welfare needs to have information about the biological father. And that sort of terminology is similar to the kind of terminology you have in adoption cases, where birth parents' rights are extinguished, the adoptive parents become the legal parent of the child, and the recommendations for contact are often to maintain a level of contact that meets the child's identity needs, rather than it being at a level that creates a relationship or maintains a relationship, where those legal ties are then severed. We then fast forward to 2024, which is the case of PQ and others of 2024 case. And again, I would just point out, this is at Mrs. Justice Knowles authority, and her opening remarks in this case, which also concerned two mothers and a sperm donor. She said this case is a cautionary tale about the consequences for a child and for same-sex couples of both deceit as to how the child came to be conceived and the unreliability of informal arrangements for artificial insemination. The fallout from this couple's separation has been devastating for each of them and for their named sperm donor. In due course, the child concerned will need an age-appropriate explanation of what happened when she was conceived and why it is that she now has a different birth certificate. So this is quite an unusual set of circumstances, but it just goes to show that the legal certainty, again, that we were all hoping would be created by the FHEA 2008 isn't necessarily what's happening in these types of cases in court. In this case, the birth mother, P, applied for the man called F to be the child's legal parent of the child, and that her former wife, Q, was not the child's legal parent. So that was the application. Q was married to P at the time the child was both conceived and born, and she was named on the child's birth certificate as the child's parent. We've already covered how that comes into force, and she had parental responsibility as a result of being named on the birth certificate. There was no dispute in that case that F was the child's genetic father. The father supported the application, but the second parent, Q, was opposed to it. The child was separately represented in that case, and the guardian felt that there would be benefit and certainty for the child about her parentage and to understand the truth of what happened. The key issue in this case was whether the child had been conceived by artificial insemination or by natural insemination, because the distinction is a crucial one. If natural insemination had occurred, then the consequences to Q would have been that she had no right, in fact, to be registered on the child's birth certificate and would not have PR. On the facts, Q said that the insemination occurred via artificial insemination, but both P, who was the child's birth mother, and father, the genetic father, said that they had natural intercourse during the conception window, and thus it was uncertain under what method the child had actually been conceived.
Right.
And there was no amount of scientific testing could determine whether it was artificial insemination or natural insemination. And so in this case, the court had to conduct a fact-finding hearing to determine what the facts were. And it was established that the burden of proof, as is the normal legal principle, lies on the person who's making the assertion.
Yeah.
And so the question for the court was whether the consent to assisted reproduction was given by the non-gestational parent, and if the condition is not satisfied in circumstances where, contrary to the belief of one of the persons in the marriage or civil partnership, assisted reproduction did not take place. Conclusion being that putting the strands together, the judge was satisfied on the balance of probabilities that the birth mother and the genetic father had sexual intercourse on several occasions prior to the third attempt at artificial insemination, for which he acted as a sperm donor. The occasions on which they had sexual intercourse were within the conception window identified by the menstrual tracker used by the birth mother. And that was used, obviously, to determine when insemination might achieve best conception.
That data was still available, was it?
Yes, and that data was still available, and it was used to show that that was the best conception window, and that was the best time to attempt the artificial insemination. But then the birth mother found out she was pregnant 2 weeks after the last occasion of artificial insemination, but the judge was unable to find, on the balance of probabilities, whether the child was conceived by artificial insemination or natural insemination.
Sure.
And so she found that the second legal parent, Q, did not consent to natural intercourse between the birth mother and the genetic father, but only to artificial insemination using the genetic father's sperm. And so in that case, she determined that the legal requirements as set out in the HFEA 2008 were not met. And therefore, the second parent was not the child's legal parent. She did not therefore acquire PR. And in fact, the child's genetic father should be treated in law as the child's second parent, and therefore it was basically invalid, was the conclusion. So one of the things that Pauline and I felt about this case was the very sad situation for Q, the parent who had intended to be the parent of that child, who had in fact raised the child as her own child, had thought she was the child's legal parent, and thought she had had parental responsibility for this child. Now, under the Children Act, there are various ways in which a person can acquire parental responsibility. Obviously, not going to set all of those out here, but you can apply to the court for an order that a child lives with you, and that would give you parental responsibility.
Right. Okay.
And you can also apply to spend time with a child, so to have contact with a child. And the court can, under Section 12(2)(a) of the Children Act 1989, consider making an award for parental responsibility alongside that order.
Right.
But that PR is limited. It's only in place when that order is in force. There's very little case law reported on these types of situations. I think it was initially introduced to allow the court to recognise a significant role that certain individuals, for example, grandparents or close family friends, might play in a child's life, even if they didn't have formal parental status. So this might be a way that somebody could acquire parental responsibility, but it certainly would not give them the legal status of being the child's legal parent, because the law only recognises two parents.
What is the scale that we're talking about, Pauline, in terms of the number of these parental order applications that are made in the average year?
Statistically, In terms of applications for parental orders, the MOJ have got records from 2021, which says there are 436 such applications made. And in 2022, there were 449. I haven't been able to track down any more recent figures than that, but we do know that there are going to be a cohort of cases where people don't apply for a parental order, and therefore they are not legally the parents of their children. One of the things that the government have tried to do through some really quite impressive work by the Law Commission is review the system by a very widespread consultation, which started in October 2019. They published a report on the 28th of March 2023 and also provided draft legislation. And one of the main reasons why this was considered so important is one of the problems with surrogacy is that you end up with the wrong people being the parents, the legal parents, at the point that the child is born. Because obviously, as we've heard, the legal mother is the person who gives birth. And if she's married, or if she's even in a civil partnership in relevant countries, provided certain conditions are met, it's likely that her partner would be the legal parent as well. Whereas the people who actually want to be the parents, because the surrogate doesn't, are the intended or commissioning parents. So the system that we have leaves children born to surrogacy in a state of limbo for probably the best part of a year after birth, because it can take that long to get a parental order. What the Law Commission recommended is, first of all, to create a new pathway to legal parenthood for domestic surrogacy, by which they mean surrogacy in the UK, which would allow intended parents to be the legal parents from birth. They've also introduced requirements and safeguards for the new pathway to ensure that it's the right decision for the surrogate and intended parents, and that the welfare of the child born is protected. Because one of the big worries from a public policy point of view has always been the notion of people potentially buying and selling children. And also that surrogates, particularly those overseas, are women who are vulnerable to exploitation. Mm-hmm. So by bringing all of this under the new regulatory system that the Law Commissioner recommended, all of those concerns were supposed to be addressed. There's also going to be reforms to the law governing payments that intended parents can make to a surrogate to provide clarity and transparency, and an effective means of enforcing limitations and, again, as I say, guard against risk of exploitations. They're also recommending that there should be new regulated bodies created called regulated surrogacy organisations, which is really bringing the not-for-profit sector into regulatory form, all of which would be under the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. And also oversee agreements. So rather than pushing this whole process under the carpet and hoping that people aren't doing it, bring it into a regulatory framework so that it is transparent. Other reforms were going to be in relation to the question of consent of a surrogate, because one of the key areas under the legislation for an application for a parental order is you have to show that the surrogate has given their consent. And that can be quite tricky in some cases, because particularly in the early days of this, when some of the surrogates were based in very rural parts of India or impoverished areas of the world, there was a real concern about whether or not the surrogate had proper advice, whether they could understand what they were reading and so forth. So the idea of the new recommended law was that in the same way as the court has the power to dispense with consent if the welfare of the child requires it in an adoption case. The Law Commission recommended that that should be brought in for parental orders. There was also going to be a surrogacy register, so we know how many cases there are and ways in which babies born of surrogacy can access information, rather like the adoption register. It was also going to introduce new employment rights and other reforms regarding nationality and immigration. Unfortunately, despite the expensive, wide-ranging, really impressive work that was done by the Law Commission, the government announced in, I think it was in April of this year, that they weren't going to implement it because they didn't consider it a priority. So we're stuck with the system that we've got, which most people would say isn't fit for purpose. And it's a terrible shame.
There was a sort of 2-year hiatus, wasn't there, between the publication of the report and that announcement by the government. In the meantime, was civil society's expectation, were campaigning groups and so on expecting that the government would at least adopt some of these changes? Did that come as a bombshell?
It was, because I think certainly once Keir Starmer was elected, one thought that the political climate would have been in favour of this reform. And it's so obvious that it's needed. We're still left in the situation where the courts, and it's particularly judges like Mrs. Justice Tice, the President Sir Andrew McFarlane, who are having to interpret the cases in front of them as best they can. So, funnily enough, there's been a spate of cases this year and late last year where the courts have felt compelled to give some really strong guidance to intended parents. I'm just going to mention a few of those cases. So in 2024, there was a case called ReZ, Foreign Surrogacy, and it was a case involving two gay men who went overseas to implement the surrogacy arrangement and ended up in a situation where their child was born in a jurisdiction, which was Northern Cyprus, where gay relationships aren't recognised. And the judge heard evidence as to how that came about. And she came to the conclusion that the intended parents had been very naive because they hadn't even considered some of the basic implications of what they were doing, and has given a list of its 16 recommendations of what people need to think about. And some of them are very obvious, things like where is the child going to be born? What is the legal framework in the country where the child is going to be born? I think in this particular case, they didn't realise that the country was Northern Cyprus. What is the surrogate's legal status when the child is born? If the surrogate's married, what does their husband or partner consider? All of the things that have been articulated in numerous cases and really do spell out why people who are going down this route need to think about getting some proper legal advice, because it really is something that requires an expert to give advice on, because there are so many pitfalls. Another case came in front of the president this year, 2025. Again, it's called ReZ, Unlawful Foreign Surrogacy Adoption. Again, this is a case that ended up in Northern Cyprus, and it was a lesbian couple who were in their late 60s, if not early 70s, so way beyond their own genetic capacity to produce an egg, unless, of course, one or other of them had frozen their eggs at an earlier point in their life, which they hadn't. And one of the key qualifying criteria for a parental order is that one or other of the intended parents has to be biologically related to the child. So if it's a lesbian couple, one of them has to have donated eggs. And if it's a gay male couple or a heterosexual couple, a man would be donating sperm or a woman would be donating her eggs. In this situation, neither of these women had any genetic connection at all. And bizarrely, they paid two surrogates to each have a baby, and are not entirely clear at what point they were told that actually they couldn't possibly pursue an application for a parental order. And they ended up in a situation where the court made an adoption order because there was nothing else that the court could do other than, I suppose, invite the local authority to be involved.
So the courts are having to make the best of a pretty impossible situation by that point.
Yes, and in fact, one of the issues that arose in that case was that the government were actually invited to intervene, because obviously there are public policy issues.
Of course.
And the conclusion that the president came to was that the court was left in an impossible situation. The government did, in this particular case, support the adoption, but they made it absolutely clear they may not do that in future cases. And this is not a precedent. And the president concluded the judgment by basically saying that the reason he was publishing the judgment was to make it clear that the overriding message for anyone seeking to follow in the footsteps of these applicants was to think again. And he endorsed the list of things that people should think through that Mrs. Justice Tice had set out in her case as being the right approach. And then we had another case very recently, Mrs. Justice Knowles. It's called Mr. and Mrs. K versus Mr. and Mrs. Z. And in that case, the intended parents were in their 70s. They were a married couple. They'd had a child of their own who sadly died. And the evidence was that they weren't seeking a surrogacy arrangement to replace their deceased son. But I'm not sure how much weight the court took to that view. But Mrs. Justice Knowles, in fact, extended the list of things that Mrs. Justice Tice set out in her judgment to include making financial provision for the child and their care, because these people were going to be 89 by the time the child was 18. And they happened to be a very wealthy couple, and they were able to satisfy the court that they had the means and had put in place the plans for the child to be looked after. But I do think these cases beg the question whether or not there ought to be some kind of regulation about how old people should be, a maximum age, as it were, to embark upon a surrogacy situation.
Yeah, I mean, there are financial needs.
Nature obviously dictates that people don't have children in their 60s and 70s. So I don't know whether that's going to be a theme that evolves in cases in the future, but there's quite a lot of learning from those three cases that one would hope people will take forward and really think through what they're doing. But I think what happens is people just get carried away. They get so excited about the idea of becoming a parent that common sense and reason seems to go out the window.
I'm just reading the letter from Baroness Merrin to the Law Commission, and she says, as you will know, the government has several key priorities that wishes to progress, which will put a significant demand on parliamentary time and resources. This means the government is unable to prioritise surrogacy reform and did not intend to put forward these legislative proposals at the current time. However, we will publish a government response as time allows, and we'll look to consider this issue in the future. So it sounds at least like there is scope for it to be picked back up in the fullness of time. Well, we'll continue then to watch a space that has now been watched for some 40 years and see whether those proposals do find their way into law anytime soon. But in the meantime, Claire Chaborowska, Pauline Troy, thank you very much for taking us through it all.